Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Kate Bealey, Deputy Personal Finance Editor, and joining me today are Personal Finance Editor Leonora Walters, Personal Finance Writer Emma Ajman, and on the phone we've got Adrian Lowcock, Head of Investing at AXA Wealth. So for investors, one of the biggest issues thrown up by Brexit so far has been the impact on commercial property funds. They've been forced to gate investors in the funds, write down the value of their assets, and some have imposed dilution levies in order to protect investors from those wanting to exit. So it's really brought to light the issue inherent to these open-ended funds which invest in illiquid assets. And that's left people wondering, and some of our readers asking, whether bond funds could face the same kind of problems. So we've been hearing a lot about the increasingly illiquid nature of bonds for a few years now, particularly corporate bonds. So we're asking, could bond funds be the next property funds? Adrian, let's talk first about these issues that we've seen in property funds and why they've suffered. What is it about property which makes it problematic?
It's basically the size of property. So you've got a large asset. You don't just buy a couple of shares for a couple of pounds. You buy a property for 5, 10, 20 million pounds or more. And that therefore means it's can be quite illiquid in times of stress, because if one person wants to sell a part of the property and the fund doesn't have enough money in cash deposits to meet that one seller, then they have to consider selling the whole property to meet one disposal, which could only be, you know, £10,000 or something, and the property size is much bigger than that. So the fundamental issue is that property is a physical object. You can't divide it into small fractions, and therefore it's not as liquid. And you add in, you know, selling a property isn't as easy as it is to sell a share. They're not traded on stock exchanges or in markets, so you don't have that liquidity there just to sort of go to someone and say, actually, I've got some shares in GlaxoSmithKline to sell. Do you want to buy them? Yes, what's the price? You can't do that with property. You've got to go and find a buyer, and then there's costs involved as well.
Yeah, so and it takes a long time.
It's a longer process of selling and buying.
And so, I mean, we mentioned shares there, but how similar are bonds to property in that case? You can divide up bonds, can't you?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's exactly. And bonds and shares are traded on the stock exchange, so there's similarities there. You can get a bond from Unilever, and it may issue, you know, £200-300 million in that bond, and you can go and trade them in smaller units. So therefore, there is the visibility and the ability to sort of sell smaller fractions means there's more liquidity around the bonds in terms of how they're structured, and that basically means, and there's a secondary market where you can go and see if there's a buyers out there to sell. So there's more ease to find out whether there are interested buyers and sellers in the bond market, and it's not so time consuming to go and sell them or buy them.
But we do hear people talking about liquidity and the lack of liquidity, particularly in the corporate bond market. So what is the problem? Are there fewer buyers of corporate bonds now?
Not as much as there's fewer buyers, it's there's fewer sellers, actually. So part of the issue with the liquidity of the corporate bonds is that they're out there, but the good stuff that people want to hold is being held. And some of that's, you know, banks holding more on their balance sheets to meet capital adequacy requirements. But also professional investors are holding the good bonds and saying, no, I wouldn't want to sell these for love nor money at the moment. And therefore the liquidity is sort of almost self-created. It's the demand that's created the lack of liquidity in the bond market. The issue is, as people get increasingly defensive, they've gone into bonds and bonds yields have fallen, and particularly in government bonds where they've gone negative across large parts of the world. The big issue is, you know, if you want to get out and sell, if everyone's trying to sell at the same time, you end up with an issue that there may be no buyers. And that's what's sort of creating that concern about liquidity. Is everyone's holding the assets? What happens when everyone wants to sell the assets?
Right. And is it that issue exactly that makes people worried about bond funds? What if we all want to get out at the same time?
That is the issue that would sort of lead to that, the comparison to the property market. What would happen if everybody wanted to get out at the same time? And effectively, you know, if everyone's trying to sell at the same time, then, you know, who are your buyers? And if you don't have any buyers, then the price of the bonds falls until somebody says, actually, at that price, I'm going to buy it. The issue is really around why that might be created. Why would everyone want to sell bonds? And the only reason you'd sort of look at it is there's two factors. I, has the risk of the investment gone up significantly since you bought it and changed? So if you're buying a company and a bond in a company, has the outlook for that company changed materially and quite significantly to create a big sell-off? And that happens all the time anyway. Companies' outlooks change all the time. But more likely it would be a change in outlook for interest rates, and it would be quite a severe change in outlook at interest rates. It wouldn't just be sort of expecting the US to maybe raise rates a couple of basis points, or you know, 0.25% here or 0.25% there. It would be interest rates rising rapidly in a very short space of time. So perhaps in the UK, instead of going down, would be going up to 3 or 4% in the space of, you know, maybe 12 months or something, and that would cause a shock to the system and cause everyone to sort of rush for the door.
Yeah, okay, so those are the things that we might need to worry about. But, I mean, just coming back to if you're trying to think through the comparison to a property fund, if a bond fund manager does need to sell assets in order to meet redemptions, is that a better situation being in a bond fund than a property fund? Are bond funds kind of more diversified?
They are, because at the end of the day, you don't need to put sort of £15-20 million into one bond fund like you do with one property. So a bond manager will also manage the duration, which is basically the time to maturity of the bonds that they hold. And they will have an average duration for the portfolio, which they're targeting or they think is a good place to be. But within that, they may hold bonds that mature in a week's time or in 2 months' time, and they'll hold bonds that may not mature for 10 years. So, you know, push comes to shove, they can actually hold on until they get their cash from the underlying borrower and wait for that cash to come through. They can also sell. They've got different quality of bonds. So some bonds will be very attractive, whilst others they might not be able to get a buyer for, but some of the better stuff they could do. And actually, that's what you could end up doing, is being forced to sell the stuff you like, not the stuff you want to get rid of first in a situation crisis. And exactly what we saw with bond managers in 2008. You know, they wanted to sell the bank debt, but actually that nobody wanted to buy that. So they were forced, if you were forced to sell, you were forced to sell stuff that you wanted to keep. Mm. And they've learned lessons from that. They've learned, you know, to manage the importance of liquidity and being able to sort of liquidate your portfolio quite quickly in times of crisis. And these things are always, you know, they're always sort of calculations that they do, and they never quite pan out in the real world when events happen. But, you know, they've learned that lesson and now do factor that into their portfolio construction.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Because people will remember 2008 and think about these bond funds, which were kind of full of, nobody knew what they were full of at the end of the day, and we'll think of that now. But bond funds today look pretty different to those kind of junk bond funds that we had back then, don't they?
One of the key issues back then was you know, the concept that bank debt wasn't good quality. You know, this is the likes of Lloyds or Barclays or HSBC in the UK. You know, they had what was called Tier 1 bank debt, and this was effectively some of the highest quality corporate debt you could have. And they had also other tiers below that. And actually, in the financial crisis, suddenly this very good quality stuff ended up being sort of almost junk status in the eyes of investors. So your best quality investments or your highest creditworthy investments actually turned out to be the highest risk assets you had. And that's what threw a lot of investors out. What managers do, you know, they've learned is effectively not getting trapped in holding too much in one area. So they're perhaps better diversified now than they had been previously. But as such, also holding that debt. So, you know, the choice is not necessarily around that it once was either.
So which bond fund or which bond areas then do you think are the most vulnerable to a correction, or, you know, vulnerable to seeing capital loss in the kind of next few years?
There's quite a broad market, and I think, you know, you've got sort of issues with currency at the moment. So, you know, areas that are always going to be subject to loss are going to be in the high yield market and things like emerging market debt, which tends to be priced in dollars but can also be local currency, and they tend to be the most volatile. You know, as the chase for yield and the hunt for yield has been sort of going on for a number of years now, the income you get on these debts has been falling. And we saw the effect of a change in outlook on the creditworthy of these at the beginning of the year in the high yield market, in particularly in the US and in the energy sector, where the oil price collapse had a big impact on that sector. And effectively, the yields went really, really high as the price fell. And that sort of gives you a factor of risk. So high yield and emerging market debts are always going to be your riskier areas, and they're the lower quality areas of the market.
But also the higher income payers, right?
They are, and that's exactly why it's sort of important to flag them, because it's really, really important that, you know, you're getting a higher income for a reason, because you're taking more risk. other than that, it's, you know, it's going to be, because I don't think we're going to see interest rate rises in the UK anytime soon, and certainly the US is going on a slower trajectory than it first anticipated on rate rises. So, you know, we are in this lower for longer interest rate environment, and they could, you know, the UK is thinking of cutting them, not raising them at the moment. So I don't think there's going to be a rush to the door. And that's good for corporates in the sense that they're not going to be under any pressure to try and sort of meet payments. If interest rates were rising, they may then struggle in that environment. And that's when you could actually see more defaults on it. So in this sort of benign environment, companies are going to sort of carry on as they were. And we shouldn't see a rise in defaults. It's when there's a shock to the system. If oil price collapsed again to back to $20 a barrel, could we see more issues in the energy sector? So it could be sector specific that we could see defaults on, and then it'll be company specific. You know, where businesses have made mistakes, or management teams have not been strong enough, and they've got themselves in trouble, and their profits just aren't there, and the company folds itself, and therefore it's stock specific. And stock specific risk is quite small impact, because fund managers, you know, do run very diversified portfolios to reduce the impact of individual stocks.
I guess for investors, if they're at all worried about bond fund liquidity, what's the best way to choose one?
The best way, I think, for most people is actually looking at a strategic bond fund, that you basically have a manager who can go anywhere from sort of government debt to all the way to the high yield space, and anywhere in between. And then that effectively means gives them the authority to make the investment decision for you, instead of you actually perhaps, you know, trying to time which part of that market you should be in. Should you be in high yield or corporate or government debt? You've got a manager who will be able to switch in and out for you and be tactical about it. And that also means that they can sort of add risk within the portfolio, and change the sensitivity to interest rate movements in the portfolio. And that's quite a good way of sort of doing that. And there's a guy called James Foster who runs the Artemis Strategic Bond Fund, who runs that sort of strategy. You know, he's looking at interest rates, inflation, the quality of the debt he's buying, you know, mixes it between investment grade, high yield, and gilts.
Okay, that's great. And I think, Anne, we're going to move on and actually look at one of the property funds which has been affected by Brexit. And it's one of our top 100 funds, M&G Property Portfolio, managed by Fiona Rowley. So, Leonora, what's been happening with the fund? It's halted redemptions, has it?
Yeah, it's suspended redemptions, like a number of property investment trusts earlier this month. Now, the reasons M&G has given are similar to what the other funds said. They were, after the vote for Brexit, received a number of requests for redemptions, a very high number of requests for redemptions. And M&G says they reached a point where we believe we can best protect the interests of a fund shareholder by seeking a temporary suspension. Now, for some funds, it was done, I think, quite simply because they didn't have the cash. M&G doesn't state that, but what they do point out is that they don't want to engage in some sort of fire sale. They don't want to, you know, just sell assets as soon as possible at a low price. And they want to do this, you know, I suppose, over time. So hopefully they can get a better price for these.
Okay, and I mean, so is that what she's referring to in your interview when she mentions being surrounded by great white sharks?
Yeah, it is quite a colourful quote. What she's saying is, after it was publicly announced that the fund had suspended redemptions and needed to raise cash to meet these, she got flooded with calls from US private equity companies offering to take the assets off her hands, but at a 15 to 20% discount. And she said she could have probably sold the entire portfolio by now, but it wouldn't have been very prudent to do so at fire sale prices, certainly not for investors remaining in the fund.
Fair enough. So what is she selling then in order to generate cash?
Okay, I mean, she didn't go into a lot of specific details, but one end of a portfolio she's targeting is, let's say, the smaller ticket items. She points out that in the last downturn, commercial property assets that kept selling were in the less than £5 million ranges and the 15 to 25 million ranges. And it's where she's getting traction in the portfolio just now.
Okay. And is that, does she generally do that then to improve liquidity? Is that something that they've changed in the fund?
Well, I don't know if she held things like that in the last financial crisis. That's something I don't know. But certainly now, the reason she has assets of this size is because they're smaller and more liquid and easier to sell. In fact, she, I think she says that, you know, these small assets, you can either sell them individually or you could sell them, you know, as a portfolio. And they certainly seem to be more popular than some of the larger assets.
Okay. And what does she say about the kind of outlook for her portfolio and how it's being affected by Brexit? Is she anticipating a write-down in the value of the portfolio?
Well, she didn't say that, but it has already had two write-downs, actually. In June, the fund's independent valuer, Knight Frank, marked it down by 1%. And in, I think it was like around the 1st of July, they marked down they did a fair value adjustment, which is equivalent to about 4.5% of the fund's net asset value.
Okay. And Adrian, what do you think about this fund and what do you think about the outlook for commercial property generally? Does it scare you or are there still good areas to invest in?
So, I mean, with regard to this fund, I mean, it's been quite well diversified. It's got, it had over 150 properties in the portfolio and it's spread quite widely throughout the UK. And, you know, prior to this this incident, you know, it had a pretty good portfolio, long lease length and low vacancy rate. So, you know, generally, nothing wrong with the fund. It's just been perhaps caught out with having less cash in it than perhaps others or more redemptions. So I think it's not a particularly specific issue with the fund. It's more what's been going on wider. And this has, I think, largely been the initial knee-jerk reaction to the referendum vote and the decision to leave. And, you know, we saw it in equity markets, we've seen it in currency markets. Bits of the markets sold off quite quickly. And property was actually no different. It just because of its lack of liquidity, it hit the headlines and has had the problems. I think going forward, there has been some opportunities created by this sell-off. We've already seen some property funds sort of revalue their portfolios back up as things have settled down. So I think the initial sort of scare is perhaps over, and you know, there's some fantastic opportunities in property. It's you know, it was fairly valued going into this year, but it looks rather attractive going forward.
That's interesting. So you don't think then that this exposes just a big flaw with open-ended property funds? I mean, do they work as fund vehicles? Is this just, you know, par for the course?
It is. If you invest in it, then it is par for the course, and you've got to be aware of that. I think there is the issue with the structure is really around everyone rushing to leave the door at the same time. If you are content to sort of remain invested and you're not a panicked investor and you've got a very long-term strategy, so you know, you bought this 2 or 3 years ago and it's part of your diversified portfolio, then you shouldn't be looking to rush through the door. And I think that's the issue. For a lot of investors, they can be long-term at the point of decision, but they can become short-term in a sense of crisis, and that's what causes the problem. So I think there does need to be a few things to address open-ended property funds, and you know, some of the issues are you add more cash into the portfolio, but that just impacts on performance. You know, investment trusts, you know, they get more volatile. So if you have real estate investment trusts, which are the closed-ended versions, they tend to have bigger swings in the share price, but at least the fund managers aren't having to be forced to sell the underlying investments, and those investors who want to stay in or even buy can take advantage of that volatility.
Yeah, well, Leonora, you look at closed-end funds a lot, don't you? What's been happening in the investment trust sector?
Well, like Adrian said, a lot of volatility. The share prices come off and the discounts have widened. They have come back in a bit. I think it'd be fair to say they're not an ideal way to invest either, because during financial crisis, the discounts to NAV and the share prices of the property investment trust absolutely tanked. I mean, some of them at the worst level, one discounts to NAV of more than 70%. So although you could theoretically sell your shares in the market, if you're investment trust, had absolutely plunged in value compared to what you bought it, you probably wouldn't want to sell it. You'd sit and wait. So in effect, you gated into that too. I think it's, you know, with commercial property funds, the open-ended versions as well, I think as Adrian says, you know, if you're a long-term investor, gating, you know, in over a few months shouldn't be an issue. And I think it's fair to say commercial property is a risk asset and you shouldn't be in it if you don't have a long-term investment horizon.
Okay, so neither perfect, basically. So moving on, finally, we are now going to take a look at a way of reducing inheritance tax bills for the assets you pass on through business property relief. And Emma's been looking at this. So Emma, what is business property relief?
Basically, it's a statutory relief and it's designed to encourage investment in small unquoted companies. And the main sort of benefit it offers is that you're able to get 100% exemption from inheritance tax if you've been holding the shares for at least 2 years before your death. And obviously, these shares need to be in the qualifying business. And that, you know, it'll come down to talk about what, you know, businesses qualify in a bit. But financial planners have been seeing a huge increase in the number of people interested in these products because there are more and more people who are finding that they're going to be paying inheritance tax. And that's due to the rise in property prices, pushing up the value of people's estates, meaning that more people are likely to be caught out by inheritance tax.
Okay, so who is it suitable for?
Well, the main purpose of, as you said, BPR is to reduce inheritance tax, and the current threshold for people who are going to have to pay inheritance tax is anyone who's got an estate of £325,000 or more. That's for an individual. For a couple, that would be £650,000. So if you've got assets that are higher than that amount, then, you know, it's something to consider because you could be in line for an IHT bill further down the line. So yes, but if you've got assets less than that, it's not really worth considering BPR because the whole point is to reduce inheritance tax. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to get the free, it's not going to affect you that at that point. So no point to consider it then. It's also a useful tool for people who, you know, think that they may face an inheritance tax problem and are in poor health or, you know, sort of worried about life expectancy. Because unlike other kind of tax relief options that are out there, you get the tax relief back after only holding the shares for 2 years, which means, you know, if you're worried about survival over that period of time, it's something to consider.
Okay, and you said not all of these unquoted companies qualify. What things do qualify for relief?
Yeah, so businesses must be unquoted trading companies to benefit from the relief. And actually, that includes many traded companies on the alternative investment market, the AIM market. However, as you point out, not all companies, you know, that fit that bill are eligible. And the main reasons why they wouldn't be eligible would be if they are primarily dealing with investments like stocks and shares or land and buildings. So really, if you're trying to think about whether or not a business is eligible for BPR, focus on businesses that effectively producing something or providing a service, anything that's just to do with kind of financial share dealing effectively, is usually exempt.
Okay. So, and you can check, can you?
Well, there's a bit of a problem with that actually, because there's not a definitive list of companies that are out there, say on the AIM market or, the range of unquoted trading companies that are out there. So it is a bit of a area that you will need to sort of look at the government's rules on what qualifies and make your own assessment if you're going to do this as an individual investor. You can also sort of outsource it effectively to managers and providers that are out there.
Okay.
And they can do that for you. So yeah, it's a tricky area, and there's different ways of getting around that.
Okay, well, I guess that is maybe one downside, but are there other downsides to holding these kind of assets or trying to use this?
Yeah, for sure. They've, as I said, got good benefits and flexibility around them, but there are downsides with everything. So the main issue is that it is a risky area because you are investing in unquoted trading companies and companies trading on AIM, and these tend to be much more volatile than other assets. So, you know, you've got to be aware that there's increased risk of default, the company going bust and you losing all the the money you've invested, in which case inheritance tax is
such a problem.
Exactly. And then there's obviously the issue of volatility, ups and downs in the market, and a bit like, you know, the discussion about property funds, liquidity is another big issue in this area. So not being able to sell your holding when you want to, or having to sell into, you know, for much less, a lower price than you can, just because liquidity is so troublesome.
Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned that you can outsource buying the assets. What are the different ways of buying and holding them?
Yeah, so as I said, you can do it yourself. Of all the people we spoke to, the experts said that it is much harder to do that than, say, if you're going to be choosing a unit trust, or, you know, it's a much harder area to do research in. So you would have to be very, you know, very confident of your abilities, and, you know, very clear about the rules and what qualifies. So, you know, that is an option. If you don't have the time or don't have the inclination, you can buy ready-made AIM portfolios from a number of providers that are out there. And the other option is that there are also providers of sort of vehicles that invest in trading and unquoted companies. So you've got the AIM side of things, and you've got the companies that are sort of, you know, not on AIM, and you can also invest in that. And there's providers of both types of products around. And yeah, I'm going to be looking at the range of products that are out there next week. So in next week's edition. So if you want to know more, make sure you take a look at the magazine next week.
Great. All right. Thanks for that. Well, I think that's all we've got time for this week. So it just remains for me to thank Emma, Leonora and Adrian. To read more about bond funds, property funds and BPR, take a look at this week's magazine. And otherwise, have a good weekend.